The London of the 18th century, Addison or Steele or Samuel Johnson, wandered the city and found interesting things to comment upon as they ran their separate gazettes. They were all of them gazetteers. Juvenal in ancient Rome was perhaps in a similar position. If you just watch the flow of life and the affectations and excitements and aspirations of talented people around you, it tends to provoke the mind to contemplation. And somebody who does an awful lot of that in our time is an old friend, Andy Ferguson. Andy, good hello. I almost said good evening, but we're in the middle of the day at the moment.
Well, it'll be evening if you want it to be. How are you, Mel?
Just fine, and I'm delighted that you're able to join us. Oh, there are so many of your pieces. I enjoy all of them, of course, and profit from them. How do you accept my representing you as a kind of Addison or maybe Samuel Johnson come again?
Oh, wow. Well, I wish I could write as well as those guys.
Well, you do in the current mode. You do, as a matter of fact.
Oh, well, I'm not so sure about that. I actually was once told by an English professor, 30 years ago almost, that if I wanted to learn how to write well, I should model myself after Joseph Addison. And anytime I would be compared to that, I'm overflattered.
You know, it's amazing. I had the very same comment from an English professor probably 40 years ago at Brooklyn College. Down to work, of your many recent pieces, and they show up regularly, of course, in the Weekly Standard, I was delighted by and fascinated by the one where obviously you were sitting in at a meeting of essentially academic science types in a lovely Berkshire hideaway.
Oh, well, that must be the illusion of print. I wasn't invited to the session of the naturalists or materialist philosophers and scientists, as they call themselves, that was held in the Berkshires. I subjected myself to watching a videotape of, I believe, all 2.5 days of their programs, and got a good sense of what was going on here. I mean, it was a notable event. It took place last November.
And some of the great stars were there. Dawkins was there, Daniel Dennett, and who else, in fact, was of the company?
Right. I compared it to the Concert for Bangladesh,
yes,
for anybody
right.
who likes old rock music. It was sort of, you know, you had George Harrison and Bob Dylan and Eric Clapton all on stage at once. So there was Richard Dawkins, who of course is the famous author of The Blind Watchmaker and other, probably the world's most outspoken advocate for the atheist point of view. Daniel Dennett, who is a quite accomplished philosopher and author of many popular philosophy books.
I had a big argument with Dennett. I had a big argument with Dennett perhaps 5 years ago on my radio program.
Oh, I would have loved to have heard that. I hope that's around because,
well, of course,
he's actually very easy to get in an argument with.
As you know, his basic position is ultimate, absolute, and uncompromising atheism.
Yes, right.
And he's
naturally given to argumentation. You know, there's the old saying about, I believe it was the philosopher Harry Jaffa, Bill Buckley said, if you think it's hard disagreeing with Harry Jaffa, just try agreeing with him. and Dennett is one of these guys who set the bar for purity so high that, I think I just mixed a terrible metaphor there. Anyway, his atheism is such a purity that not many people can live up to it.
What was the shared creed that unified the consciousnesses of all of the participants at this conference, even though they would all insist that consciousness itself is a kind of an illusion?
Right, of course, which does present a philosophical and practical problem, you would think, but they managed to steamroll right over it. Well, the conference was called Moving Naturalism Forward, and it was basically, you know, what they called it, a workshop. It's the guys sit around at a table with little glasses of ice water and trays filled with little candies and things, and gave presentations about where does materialism go from here. And by materialism, it also goes by the name of naturalism. It's basically, as you say, the belief that scientific experiments and observations have revealed to us in outline anyway, all that really exists in the world, that there is really nothing but, as one of them put it, molecules in motion.
Exactly.
The sense that we have of being sort of independent selves, or of having a will that we can command to one degree or another.
Love, volition.
Over time, those things are all illusions.
All illusions. Love is an illusion. Volition is an illusion. Indeed, meaning itself is an illusion.
Yes, and I think that's where the materialist view starts to bump up against itself. You know, it's very hard to actually be a human being in the world and live as though you believe materialism is true, because I think that, you know, if you're someone who doesn't think that he has some kind of control over his will, if he thinks that other human beings are simply molecules in motion, big sort of, you know, meat puppets motivated by amino acids and all that sort of thing, that there is no reality or objective reality to good and bad, you know, you're not just a materialist in that case, you're a psychopath. Now, these guys are not psychopaths. I'm sure they're all moral men and women who you know, try and do good by their families and their students and so on. But there is no objective support for that kind of life in their own philosophy.
But, you know, if one of them, in a heat of passion, though passion itself is illusory, but still in the heat of some kind of passion of jealousy or rage, killed somebody else and ultimately went on trial, he would, if he were totally consistent, be able to plead simply, all of this was just molecules in motion. It had nothing to do with my will. There is no will. I cannot be found guilty of an intent to murder because my very intention is illusory. We are essentially shadows of the physical world in action, but we have no real control over anything that we do. We even have reason to doubt that we exist, for that matter. You could even invoke Berkeley's idealism.
Absolutely, and like I think it was Dr. Johnson who tried to refute Berkeley's belief in the unreality of material things by kicking a stone.
Thus do I refute Bishop Berkeley, he said.
Yes, and you know, he hurt his toe, and that was pretty real. This actually, you're touching on a point that I think really worries professional materialists and naturalists, and it came up over and over again at this conference, this workshop in the Berkshires, and it exposed actually a division between these very devout materialists, unanimous in their conviction that material is all that there is in the world. Dan Dennett worries exactly about the problem that you put your finger on. How do people live if they don't believe that they have some kind of responsibility for their own personal will and acts that they undertake? Now, Dan Dennett knows darn well that, according to his philosophy, science has proven that people do not have that kind of control over their actions, that in fact everything has been determined by individual causes from the beginning of the Big Bang. What does that kind of idea, once it seeps into the general population, what does it do to civilization itself? And then it worries, I think quite rightly, that it becomes sort of an escape valve, and without notions of personal responsibility and good and bad in objective terms, you begin to have a breakdown of the things that keep the civilization going.
That could very well lead him to a deep inconsistency in which disdaining and rejecting religion as obviously a web of fiction and fantasy and totally untrue, at the same time one recognizes that religion, for the troops, if not for the officers, is required to maintain the social order.
Yes, exactly. I think it was one of the interesting things about Christopher Hitchens's huge selling book about God is Not Great. He said that, you know, religion ruins everything. I think that was his title, How Religion Ruins Everything. And there are a school of materialists who will say that, well, actually it doesn't, because it serves this useful social purpose by infusing ordinary folk with the illusion of personal responsibility. You can actually construct social institutions that, account for punishment of crime and, contracts and all the kinds of things that we need to survive in a civilized society.
I've got a modern story for you. You may well know it. It all transpired only within the last few years. You know the name Paul Kurtz?
Yes, I do know the name.
Paul Kurtz was more or less the founder of the American Humanist Society. He was the inventor and founder and proprietor of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, on whose board I served for a while. A materialist philosopher who was quite atheistic, yet a very genteel and pleasant man. And he organized. He organized and organized everything. He's got all sorts of organizations, all sorts of publications, and many, many followers. His own institution for investigating the world with a strong materialist skepticism up there just alongside the University of New York at Buffalo, where he was professor of philosophy for most of his career. But towards the very end of Paul's life, his troops revolted against him. They felt, because he had started writing essays and making speeches in which he said, we mustn't be so hard on religion. We mustn't be so contemptuous of those who hold a kind of a faith which differs considerably from our own. There may even be some meeting ground, and even if there isn't true intellectual meeting ground, one recognizes the social functionality and value of the illusions that people live by. And for that, for saying that, as he did in a number of essays, he was discharged from his own movement. And his leadership was taken away. The publication was taken away. They locked him out of his office in the headquarters of their organization in Amherst, New York. And Paul quickly started another organization, which was essentially committed to the notion that we have to make friends with the materialists, rather as materialists, we have to make friends with those who have faith in something or other and who tend to be critical of us, or else somehow we're not making the full proper contribution, even as we try to educate the world to the proper view, which of course we hold. But I have the sense that maybe the fact that his troops turned against him in a way, he was rejected by many of them, may have speeded his untimely death. He was, to be sure, into his 80s and thus sooner or later was going to die, but it came somewhat sooner. And I knew him moderately well and enjoyed him a great deal. It's sort of a sad story to me.
Well, you know, it's also a cautionary story because, I deal with all different kinds of people. I write a lot about politics and I encounter doctrinaire ideologues every day. And I'll tell you, I don't think that I've ever confronted anyone, whether in the cloisters of the Catholic Church or in the depths of the Democratic National Committee or the Republican National Committee, who is as intolerant and doctrinaire in a kind of totalitarian way as the philosophical materialist. I mean, these guys have a line, and it is an absolutist position, and you simply can't depart from it, which is why I say this bone of contention between the two sides of the materialist was so interesting. I mean, Dennett would never say that free will actually existed. He will say that common people need to be told that free will exists in a certain kind of way. And then he has a very elaborate explanation of how free will does exist, but really doesn't. And it's never made much sense to me, so I can't paraphrase the argument. But there then are others who just say, no, people have to grow up. They have to learn that they are nothing but molecules in motion. They are organisms that do not have free will. And they're just going to have to suck up the truth.
But, you know, there are others with Scientoid sort of styling of their lives and their careers who have taken a different position. Not so much the serious elementary particle physicists, but those who read them and draw something from it. We now know if only on the basis of Heisenberg's indeterminacy principle and all that followed thereupon, we now know that molecules in motion isn't really the full story at all. Molecules sometimes jump to other dimensions. Molecules sometimes produce parallel molecules in different settings. And indeed, if you go to some of the great energy wheels, as at CERN or wherever, you find very, very strange behavior, suggesting that, in fact, cause and effect isn't the way things really work necessarily, suggesting that there are realities beyond our comprehension and beyond easy fit into a materialistic scheme.
Well, you know, that points up another very interesting reaction to this article when it appeared about a month ago in the Weekly Standard about materialism. I got a huge amount of mail, by my standards anyway, and lots of letters from physicists who were absolutely disavowing this concept of materialism or naturalism as they use it.
So you heard you heard from some of the folks I've just been talking about.
Yes, absolutely. And in an interesting, I ended up talking to several of them, and a couple made the point that part of the scientific materialist now you generally find in sciences that are is not yet as well developed as physics has become. When you look at evolutionary biology, or certainly evolutionary psychology or social psychology, as you well know, they're not mature sciences in the sense that physics is. If you had talked to a physicist 75 years ago, you probably would have found him to be a materialist of one kind or another. But the findings of physics have now progressed to the point where it's simply absurd to say that every biological activity can be reduced to some physical or some aspect of physics, because physicists know that that's just not true. So when you do find scientists, rigorous scientists, who you know, are kind of embarrassed by the crudity of Dennett and Dawkins, they're very often physicists.
You know, speaking of social psychology, one simple maxim that holds generally is that one good way to unify a group, if there are possibly elements which are disruptive of the group, if there are maybe some doubts which are disruptive of full faith in the shared vision or the shared ideology, one way to hold that group together is to find an external enemy, or even better, to find a heretic who has abandoned you and therefore needs to be properly analyzed and vilified. And that's just what happened at that meeting. I want to talk with you about that right after we pause just briefly for some messages. And directly back to Andrew Ferguson. Ferguson of the Weekly Standard, who occupies a unique role, I would say, at that fine magazine. They let you wander wherever you want and comment on whatever you want in long, brilliant, and ultimately readable, utterly readable, and ultimately sometimes comic articles.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm very lucky. I've got I got about the best job in showbiz, as they say.
Well, you deserve it, and you provide great showbiz performance, to say the least. And conservative magazines need a little showbiz, I would say, or else the utter seriousness of everything.
I'm with you on that, that's for sure.
But I was hinting that we need to talk about the fascinating case of Thomas Nagel.
Yeah. About a month before this conference in the Berkshires was held, Thomas Nagel, who I guess is probably the most famous American philosopher, which, you know, also to quote Bill Buckley, is sort of like being the tallest building in Topeka. you know, he's been, I guess he's in his late 70s now. I remember when I was taking philosophy classes as an undergraduate in the 1970s, everybody had to read a very famous essay that had come out a few years before by Nagel called "What Does It Mean to Be? What Is It Like to Be a Bat?"
Yeah.
Which is a wonderfully readable and provocative, and really a landmark paper. So anyway, Nagel, I think by people who really understand Nagel shouldn't have been terribly surprised by what Mind and Cosmos, the book that came out, really dealt with. But it was all captured in the subtitle, quite provocative subtitle, which was why the neo-Darwinian explanation of the world is almost certainly false, which is, of course, a bullet aimed right between the eyes of Dan Dennett and Richard Dawkins and the whole materialist enterprise. And so here you had a guy who, he's a university professor at New York University. He's been at Princeton for 15 or 20 years. He's covered in garlands by every kind of intellectual organization in America. And all of a sudden, he's gone rogue. And he's left the reservation.
Which must mean he's gone crazy.
Yeah.
Or else,
something suspect about his motives.
Somebody might have bought him off with the equivalent of a handful of silver.
Yeah. This is one of the signs of a really bankrupt philosophical or political or intellectual position, when the first response of people that you disagree with is that to question your motives. You know, okay, who's buying him off? What kind of professional advancement is he after? Who's he trying to impress? Basically, that means that you've run out of energy.
Now, Andrew,
I think that that's what's happened.
As you read him and perceive him, what do you take to be the essence of Nagel's true argument?
Well, I call it, and I don't think he would much like this word or this phrase. I say in the piece that Mind and Cosmos is a work of philosophical populism. And by that I mean he wants to take our everyday experience of the world, the one that we all know that we have, regardless of what some silly analytic philosopher or some scientist might say, this experience that we have of the world is generally accurate, and that it, because it can't be accounted for by the materialist explanation of the world, must in some sense disprove the materialistic explanation of the world. That is, if materialism tells you that the self doesn't exist, that there are no colors or sounds in the world, that there is no self, that doesn't count against the conventional view that there is a self and free will and so on. That counts against materialism. So we've got to figure out what is it about materialism that is wrong, that it could arrive at conclusions that are so self-evidently absurd.
One of the Viennese circle of logical positivist philosophers, I forget which one, was given to saying of various other philosophical ideas that seemed to him unacceptable. Had a simple way of designating that they were just simply wrong. And it was in German, aber das ist ganz sinnlos. But that's utter nonsense.
Yes, right, right.
You don't have to go beyond that to prove it.
This is kind of Nagel's position. I mean, there's a kind of exasperation that creeps into it. And although he does make arguments that are actually quite methodical and sober and well-grounded in experience and our knowledge of the world, but basically it's, can we just cut the crap? You know,
yes.
I mean, it's kind of like, we all know this isn't true, so why do we have to pretend it's true?
The quotation I've just come up with, I'm unsure. It's either from Ernst Cassirer or Rudolf Carnap. But either way, sometimes you just know that something is ganz sinnlos. Lacks
yes, sense. Right. That's beautiful. And this is exactly, I think, where we are now, and it's why... It's also one of the reasons that these materialist philosophers and scientists got together at the Berkshires. Is how do we beguile people away from what they see as a very sentimental and unscientific view of the human condition?
How do you relate this? How do you relate this to the larger question, and indeed, Dennett and Dawkins and others did whole books on it, the general rise of the new atheism, and indeed the secularization trends that one does see in Western society generally, more perhaps in Western Europe than in the United States, if only measured by who goes to church on Sunday, or whether any Jews are still orthodox enough to take their many obligations seriously, their many prayers seriously. And of course, the answer is yes, there are lots of religious people, but there are more irreligious ones now, or beyond religion types who'll say, yes, I'm spiritual, but I don't believe any of that stuff. That's just mythology. How do we relate that to the what's going on in the realm of the philosophy of science and the lives of the guys who sat around those lovely tables in the Berkshire Inn?
Right. Well, I think there's no question but that there's the decline of religiosity and of religious practice and the rise of irreligion or, you know, as you say, spirituality, which is sort of a nice, cozy little word where people get to be religious without having any of the obligations or the burdens that being religious places on a person. And this materialistic view in a very pop form, which I think is seeped into the well water of American life, of American intellectual life. If you go to college now, and you take a smattering of biological sciences or physical sciences or some other kind, you start to absorb this materialism just from your environment. I mean, this is the view that Dawkins and Dennett hold are essentially the view of the intellectual elite in America and certainly in Europe, less so in America. And there's a trickle-down effect. There's no question but that if someone is sort of vaguely educated and you kind of think about these things but not too much and you read a little bit here and there, you are going to start to figure out that, well, really sophisticated people, scientists, for example, Daniel Dennett, the great philosopher, really sophisticated people kind of realize that the world is really nothing but material and that there is something fundamentally fundamental about science today that puts the lie to all of our beliefs in free will and a soul and so on. And then from that kind of class of vaguely educated people, that seeps down even further. And when it gets to that level, you know, this is what I think is alarming about it, and I think this is one of the reasons Nagel is such an important person right now, an intellectual figure, is that it does end up as a kind of nihilism. You know, it the last stage of this sort of pop materialism that we have is a sense of, well, you know, we're all dying. There's really no objective morality that anyone has to uphold. A lot of the sense of personal obligation and free will that we have isn't really true. So it doesn't really matter so much about what I do or what so-and-so does. And there is no overarching structure of life that can kind of compel us to behave in one way or another.
But you know, as you examine all of this and proceed in this direction, it's very pro-social, it's pro-community, it's pro-decency. And one has the sense of religion, if we're restored and deeply held and seriously held, would probably be good for the world and good for the people who inhabit this latter day of cacophonous individuality. But, mm-hmm. but. To give proper credit to the opposition, so to speak, one has to note that from Victorian times on, when it came to educated people, there's been deep doubt about the central narratives of religion, particularly, of course, of Christianity.
Yeah.
And the story of the resurrection, et cetera, simply doesn't work for people who wish that it did work for them. That's part of the modern dilemma. It's lined out in many Victorian novels of young men who lose the faith, and it persists to our time. I know that you're more Christian than I am, since I'm of Jewish background. But even as a Jew, you know, I am pleased to be Jewish, and I know something of the tradition. But I cannot take the story of Moses as in any sense literal, and I cannot take most of the Old Testament, except where it begins to probably reflect something about the tribal histories of the Middle East about 3,000 years ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is also where Nagel is so interesting and important. Nagel is an unabashed, unapologetic atheist. He is trying to camp out in a some position between the religious, spiritual or philosophers or theologians on the one hand, and these dogmatic materialists on the other. There's nothing about him that is going to ever suggest that, he believes in the Nicene Creed and the resurrection of the dead or anything like that. In fact, he even says in one of his really wonderful articles that, you know, if I started believing in the Nicene Creed or the New Testament, I wouldn't think I was having a revelation. I'd think I needed to have my head examined. So he's not at all an unmodern thinker in that sense. He's not trying to drag people back to the enslavement of the church and so on. He's just trying to point out this materialistic view of the world simply doesn't hold water, and B, we have experience of the world that is true and real that can't be accounted for by what has now become the sort of secular humanist dogma. So what else is there? If we agree that religion can't be true, which is what he thinks, what else can there be? Materialism isn't true, religion isn't true, so where does that
leave us? You just used the word secular, and of course the opposite of secular is sacred, and the key to religion is that it relates to conceptions of the ultimate sacred things or sacred realities. What that points up is that for moderns who are beyond or are somehow disaffected from the classic narratives of the three great Western religions, what is needed is some new way of defining the sacred and seriously internalizing the sacred as beyond mere materiality. And mm-hmm. that, I think, is what a good deal of the struggle in life is about. The struggle in modern thought and in modern art and so on is really about. Many investments in falsely sacred commitments, which ultimately lead to perdition or lead to dismay rather than to fulfillment.
Yes, or worse than dismay and perdition even. It's also true about Nagel and his atheism. He does, in Mind and Cosmos, he does kind of a psychological examination of materialism. How does one come to believe something that is so flatly untrue as a materialistic account of human life? Well, he says, he searches his own thinking and that of his friends and intimates, and he said there's something among the intellectual class that he calls a fear of religion. And he says this is very strong in myself, meaning Nagel. I do not want the world to be the way Christians and Orthodox Jews would say that it is, with a creator God who has all kinds of moral strictures and straitjackets that we have to fit ourselves into. I don't want that world to be true. And so he accounts for the rabid materialism of a lot of the intellectuals simply by the fact that they're kind of afraid that if it were true, life would simply be unlivable if religion were true.
Yes.
So that's actually kind of flips it on its head, because we're used to having materialists and secularists say how people, you know, are only religious because it makes them comfortable or it flatters their own self-worth or whatever. He's turned that on its head.
It may be the ultimate answer to Freud's anti-religious treatise, The Future of an Illusion.
Yes, right. Right, which is which I have actually reread about 10 years ago, and I thought, you know, I used to think this was a great book.
Yes.
What went wrong? So, anyway.
Well, it laid out a good deal of the materialist kind of stance.
It's a text.
These are illusions, and we're growing up and we're putting those illusions aside. When I was a child, I spake as a child. Now that I'm a man,
right.
I put aside childish religiosity. You know, I owe you an I owe you an apology. We're just about out of time, and I've taken all of the time to just get you talking about and to discourse with you in response to one of your recent pieces, when indeed there are 20 others just published within the last year or so, which we could easily have talked about.
I'm happy to talk with you at any time. Believe me, Milt, it's always a great pleasure.
Just give me, if you would, give our listeners a brief taste of what you do in the recent essay, Pop Goes the Culture.
Oh, well, that's actually kind of on the sort of on these same themes.
It is related, yes.
It was. I write about a guy named Ken Myers, who's actually a sort of an orthodox Christian, not really a political conservative in any sense, but a very interesting guy. And he does something that I think is very rare among popular religion now, which is to try and think seriously about theology and morality and politics and the cultural questions generally. And he does an interview, audio magazine, he calls it, sort of like a podcast. And it was absolutely so refreshing to me to sort of stumble across this guy who thinks that a religious point of view doesn't have to be the pop point of view. It doesn't have to be Joel Osteen, you know. It doesn't have to be rock and roll religious music or any of that stuff. That in fact there is a great treasure that that Western religion has, and that it can still hold on to and use as a tool to advertise itself, even.
And I've asked you nothing about and given you no chance to talk about the Washington Follies as they are flourishing these days.
Well, but there's a lot of them, aren't there?
There are indeed. I happily recommend to all who are listening the further essays of Andrew Ferguson to be found in the Weekly Standard. It's been a delight talking with you again. I hope we can do it again fairly soon.
Oh, please. I hope so too, Milt. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Andy, for joining us.
You bet.
Summer.